Hello and welcome to the Choreocrime podcast. We're your hosts, Kate
and Ashley. And today we're going to be talking about Ubomkon and the Iryong massacre, which was, until 2011, the worst mass shooting in history. So I'm going to be setting the stage and giving a background on the criminal, Mr. Woo, as well as the crime itself. And then Caitlin will be delving into the impact of the tragedy.
By the way, be sure to check out our other episodes on choreocrimepodcast.com. That's spelled K-O-R-Y-O, crimepodcast.com. And we're going to be doing our first video episode today, so please check it out on our YouTube channel as well.
Okay, so today you'll be able to see and hear us. Okay, so I want to first start off this podcast by giving a little historical context or historical background, because this was there was a lot going on in Korea at this time, and that's important to note and be cognizant of. So, Woo Bong-kon, who I'll just call Mr. Woo from now on, or Woo, was born into South Korea. He was born into a South Korea that is not the Korea we know today. It is not K-pop and it is not Olive Young, okay? We're not over there like, oh, look at my new product from Olive Young. No, this is a Korea after the immediate effects of the war. So it's a very poor country at this point that he was born into. So also, we're not even sure exactly when he was born. We know the year. He was born in 1955. Of that much, we're sure. But the actual day has been disputed because there's been some manipulation or deletion in the historical record by the powers that be back then. So what I mean here is that the Korea Mr. Woo grew up in and the presidential regime under which he died, it's very different than the one today. So the president at the time of Mr. Woo's massacre and suicide was Chun Doo-hwan. So he was what we would call an army general that became a military dictator. So he forced his way into leadership in 1979 and then cemented his position in 1980 with a military coup. So he was the man responsible for the Gwangju massacre on May 18th, 1980. And that led to the death of more than 200 protesters advocating for a democratic government. And that tragedy today still leaves a little bit of a bad taste in like the Gwangju sort of area people's mouths. They have a little bit of, how do I, they have some bad feelings about that and the history of it and like Seoul in general a little bit. There's a little bit of a not good feeling between the two from what I've heard.
And I'm also going to show on the map where this actually happened.
Okay.
In a little bit.
Okay. Now, at the same time, by the way, there's a film about this president. It's actually quite interesting. I'll ask my husband about it because it actually gives a really good historical context about what it was like back then. So I'll find that and I'll put it in our notes. So anyway, at the same time, he is credited with the creation and rise of a lot of industry in Korea. So my husband said the feelings are, my husband is Korean. My husband said the feelings are quite mixed about him. Like, was he a good guy by any stretch of the imagination? Absolutely not. But he is responsible for a lot of the rapid industrialization in Korea, which brought it out of that, you know, post-war depression and into modernization. So let's get into it. Again, the exact details of this case are shaky at best because the government did not want this on the record. They did not want him to be remembered. They wanted him basically to go away. And because of that, a lot of details have been tampered with or changed. So a lot of our sources were actually like foreign newspapers as well as some internal sources. So Ubomkon's origins, as previously mentioned, are a bit what we would say amorphous. So whether it's because of the time period in which he was born, maybe less note-taking, less there's less registration for everything, or the fact that he was actively removed from the historical record, we're not exactly sure, maybe a mix of both. But what we do know is that he was born in 1955 in Busan, and he was the fourth boy to be born to his family. So at that point, there's probably not a lot of attention being paid to him. He was said to be the most introverted of the four, and he was not particularly interested in schoolwork as he was growing up. It wasn't rare for him to skip class, though he did have dreams of becoming a police officer just like his father. Now, skipping class these days is a huge eh-eh, but back then, I'm not exactly sure, because like in Korea now, it's school. You have to pass that that basically Korean equivalent of the SAT. You have to get into a good school. Your whole future depends on it. So unfortunately, Mr. Woo's father passed away sometime before his high school graduation, which ultimately Mr. Woo did complete, but just barely. He barely managed to pass that test. So after his father's death, he became even more troubled, and he would have run-ins with the law due to violence, and he seemed to be suffering from anger management issues. Now, again, some historical context here. So he was born to a father immediately after the Korean War. So the Korean War ended in 1953. Mr. Woo was born in 1955. So guessing or assuming that his father had actively participated in the war, then he was being raised most likely with what was called shell shock back then, but PTSD these days. So he was probably in a home where his father's emotions were extreme and unregulated. And we have to take into historical context that this is not the more democratic, this is not the more egalitarian household. Women were doing all of the housework. Men were kind of doing, like, they were expected to work, and that was their job, provide. So if the father didn't have an outlet, I'm guessing that the housing situation, his home life might have been very tense. You, what do you think?
Yeah, definitely. Just from some of the pictures that you see from the war, you can just imagine the devastation. And I'll talk about that a little bit later, about the devastation and stuff. But Dad didn't really want to talk about it a lot. And a lot of people died and families were torn apart. And
Yeah. So again, that's what he was growing up with. And no way is this excusing anything he did, because it was ridiculous. It would be ridiculous to do that, but it's just providing a background. So imagine Mr. Woo's surprise when he goes from being kind of an outcast or someone who is not celebrated in any way to joining the military. So of course in Korea we have mandatory, like I'm joining the military. In Korea they have a 2-year, or I think it's shorter, like 18 months these days. Yeah. So mandatory military service. So back then though, 2 years. So every male by the age of, I think, 30-something has to join the military for 2 years. 20? But that's usually when they take the break. I think there's like a, you know? Because
you
some
can delay it.
Mm-mm.
If you go to school and stuff, you can delay it. But I think it's 20 or something.
Ah, okay. My bad then.
But you can delay it. Hi everyone, Kate here, just with a editing note. So the correct ages for conscription in South Korea are from 18 to 35. So we were in that range. But yes, 18 to 35. Thank you. Back to the episode.
So basically, they owe the government two years back then of service. So he joined the military, and then he became the star of his regiment. He was like a rock star when it came to His ability for sharpshooting, he was very highly skilled, and he was commended for his excellent marksman / sniper skills. And at the end of his service, he went on to work as a police officer in the Gangnam district of Busan, where apparently he had an affinity for hitting villagers who looked at him the wrong way or suspects during interrogation. And this earned him the nickname Mad Tiger.
I can assume that the police protections were not the same as now.
I don't, cops these days generally can't go around hitting people on the street. No. Not a thing. Anyway, so that same year in April, he was assigned a special unit in Seoul in charge of protecting the presidential house, Cheongwaede, or the Blue House, basically the Korean equivalent of the White House. So this was a great opportunity. And if he had, you know, taken it seriously, that would have been a career, because that's a really big job, protecting the president. But it was a short-lived opportunity, because after only a few months, he was demoted to a position in Iryong, I'm going to trip over that word, I'm sorry, county. And this county is located in South Gyeongsang Province, Gyeongsang Namdo. Also known as Gyeongsang Namdo. Iryong is one of the least populated counties in Korea. So to be demoted from a very populated area, a sort of the Blue House area, it's in a nice area, you know, there's a lot going on, there's a lot to do, and then to be sent out to literally the boonies. It's not a good sign. It's not a good reflection for you. Two, you might feel like it's a slap in the face, right? But his demotion was because he had behavioral issues as a result of his heavy drinking. So he was basically constantly drinking, and he had problems because of that, as you would. So
let's look at where it is. Okay, so let's take a look. Where did this happen? So Ashley's going to get into kind of what exactly happened, but let's look. So this is where it was. Gongnyeomyeon. So this is like a small area. Myeon is kind of like a small area. So it happened in this area. So if we look at the larger map of Korea, let me zoom out. You can see that it's by Jinju, Changwon, and the big city is Busan, Daegu, and Ulsan. So Busan is not that far away, and neither is Daegu. So these are pretty big cities. Busan is the second largest city in Korea. Now, so getting kind of pushed from, let's go to Seoul. Seoul is up here. Seoul is here. Over here is the airport. Here is Seoul. And then you go all the way down here. So he went from the Blue House all the way down here.
The middle of nowhere.
In the middle of nowhere. It is literally countryside. If you look it up, I'll keep the name up here. If you look it up, it is extremely countryside. Well, I guess we can look at the terrain. But it is extremely, extremely
rural.
Yeah, sorry, I'm forgetting words, but yeah, look at it's all just
green. Oh yep,
it's all just green, which is beautiful probably, but not when you're, you know,
When you're used to the city life at this point.
Yeah, not when you're used to working in Seoul. Okay, I'll stop sharing that now. All right, Ashley, continue. Sorry about that.
No worries. So remember, everyone, that this is, at this point, the very, very early 80s, right? So there is no MBTI. There are no psych evaluations upon entering the police force. So there wasn't anything, well, there wasn't anything technical to alert the police that Mr. Wu was a pressure cooker waiting to explode. I think in the 1970s, there was kind of an epidemic of pressure cookers that were being vaulted through their ceilings because of like hatch mishandlings. So they would turn into bombs. Yeah. So yeah, the pressure wasn't being released properly. So instead of like, it was more like kaboom. And they would literally be vaulted through ceilings. My mom told me about this, how she was always nervous to use pressure cookers because of the faulty ones in the 1970s. Now, like I say, there's no technical test to show that someone may be prone to mental illness or mental breakdown. Then again, this guy was drinking like a fish and had been demoted. So, people may have thought that Mr. Wu was upset about his demotion, but maybe they didn't have any reason to think that he would do something rash because of it. But it's always, people always underestimate other people. So let's paint a picture of Mr. Wu in Uiryong. Now, this is, like we said, this is a very small county. This is basically rural countryside. So there is nothing to do but gossip and, I don't know, own a farm. Yeah, farm and gossip. So people gossip, like I said, like they're wont to do in any community. Why did this new police officer, sorry, where did this new police officer work before? Well, if he worked in the Blue House, why is he suddenly stationed here? What did he do? How did he screw up? Do we have like a reject police officer in our community? So all of this kind of gossip would get back to him because, you know, it always does. So it's just my speculation, but knowing people, if word got out about Mr. Wu's demotion to the local people in Uiryong, I think he would have lost face. And face is very important to have to keep in Korean culture. You do not want to look stupid in front of other people. It's not good. So another factor that may have affected Wu to the, or was the fact that he had a live-in girlfriend. This is Jeon Mal-sun. Jeon Mal-sun. So to put this in perspective, even these days, it is not common to move in with your fiance before marriage. It's seen as a little like, basically you live separately until you are married.
And there's no common law in South Korea. So
yeah. So it doesn't matter how long you've lived with someone,
or at least
you're not married. Fine. Yeah. So yeah, same. I'll actually ask. Yeah. Okay. So of course it's going to be a case-to-case basis these days, but the majority of people, like I said, live with their parents until marriage. And it's very common to live with or near parents-in-law after marriage. So I know a lot of Koreans will have their parents live with them after. Or at like in the same house, in the same apartment building. So in a very small town, people were going to talk. And the word wasn't good because cohabitation without marriage at that time was pretty strongly frowned upon. So the impetus for the tragedy is, I mean, in a word, ridiculous. So, well, I mean, honestly, it's never the actual thing that they said. It's always like, the internal events leading up to it, you know?
For sure.
So on the afternoon of April 26th, 1982, Wu was awoken from his sleep by his girlfriend swatting or brushing, or some reports say hitting a fly off of his chest. So basically like some kind of like slap, but not on purpose, basically to get a fly off of you or to kill a fly. Now,
like he apparently,
yeah, I'm not like, oh, you were having a nightmare. Oh, he apparently flew into a rage and he fought with Miss Jun before storming out of the house. These events, by the way, are also, I tried my best to put this in order because different sources say different things. So at 4 o'clock that same day, he reported for duty at the police station where it's reported that he began drinking heavily. But this is a fact up for debate because witnesses and survivors would say later that who didn't seem intoxicated. And we showed you the picture of the area he's in. It was mountainous. So how's an Ajusshi basically at this point, who's drunk and stumbling around, going to cover 2.5 miles because he kind of did a 2.5 mile loop through rocky countryside? It would have been all but impossible, is what most witness accounts say. Now, like I said, timelines here are disjointed and fractured at best. So some sources say that Wu assaulted his girlfriend before leaving for work. Others say he yelled at her. Others say he beat her at 7 p.m. before returning back to the station. But what is known is that at some point during the night, he did beat her before returning to the station's armory and raiding it. He equipped himself with 2 M2 carbines. These are guns. A carbine, basically a repeater, is a gun. 7 grenades, 2 handguns, and over 180 rounds of ammunition. Now, at around 9 p.m., very, very heavily armed and in rage because someone swatted a fly off of his chest, he gunned down 3 people in the street, killing them all before heading into the post office. Now, this is 1982. Remember, we do not have cell phones. If you take out the phone lines, there is no way to contact the outside world. He murdered everyone in sight, including the switchboard operators, which effectively cut the town's communication from outside sources. So calls aren't coming in, they're not getting out. Because remember, switchboard operators are the ones who are literally like you make the phone call, connect. He apparently also cut the lines manually, but allegedly one phone operator managed to restore a single line back to functionality before they succumbed to their wounds. So Wu then went to Torongni and threw grenades into a marketplace and shot people on the street, and he killed 6 there. He also shot his girlfriend, who had left the house because of the commotion in the marketplace. So the story is, she's already been beaten. She hears the noise in the marketplace and she goes to check it out. He shoots her there. He continued traveling village to village, taking advantage of the trust most people would give him because of his uniform. He used it to open doors and then would murder whoever was unlucky enough to be on the other side of that door. So, you know, but the thing is, like, if I see a police officer tuk, 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 on my door, I'm going to open it because I think I'm in trouble or I think something's wrong.
Well, especially if there's a commotion outside, maybe they think that the police officers are coming to get them out or to help them.
Yeah, but no, the call is coming from outside the house, unfortunately, and it's coming to get them. So at around 10:30, now this honestly is, I mean, of course, the entire thing is sad, but this part kind of got me. So at around 10:30, Wu took a 16-year-old hostage and led him to Ungeri, where he ordered the boy to buy him a soda. And this is a direct quote from the person who owned the market. The patrolman came to my house leading a student, the shopkeeper from whom they bought the drink said. He asked for a soft drink. I gave him one. He had only one gulp and then shot the student, killing the boy there. Then he fired shots at my wife and 2 of my children. They all died on the spot. Running out of my house, I was hit in the leg. So the shopkeeper survived, but part of his family was murdered in front of him, as well as a young boy he didn't know. And many others were also not so lucky. So Wu moved on to the local market and shot 18 there before continuing on. So in Pyeongchonli, after killing a man in his house, Wu was invited into a funeral vigil. Now, again, sources differ. They say a party, a funeral. So but funerals here are not, how do I describe this? They're not like Western funerals. They last for 3 days and you have a lot of people coming in. They pay their respects by bowing, and they also give money, and then they'll eat. So it's not uncommon to have people that you might not necessarily know because your parents knew them, or they might be a friend of your brother or sister. So it's very common to have what would be seen like random people stopping by.
I think also because, if you're in a small place too, like a rural community members would just come to show their respects, right?
Yeah, I think that would be, I think so, but especially back then, because, you know, the community is quite a, probably a bit more connected than it is these days. So it wouldn't be so strange to have a random police officer just roll up and say, what's going on? So after eating with the family and complaining about his low salary and transfer to a countryside police station, someone in the funeral party remarked to Wu that his ammunition looked fake. So it's unclear whether he used grenades or guns or both, but his response to the comment ended the lives of 12 at the funeral vigil and another 8 passersby on the street. So as Wu's reign of terror came to a close, he took a family hostage in Gongryu, telling the head of the household, So Insu, that's the person's name, that's the man's name, that he was chasing a communist spy and that the family should gather together in one location so he could protect them. Instead, he held them for over 2 hours until the police finally figured out his location. Now, a huge criticism, and I think some firings were made after this event, because the police were criticized as they were alerted of the shootings minutes after their occurrence. They knew about it minutes after, but it took over an hour to put a 37-member team together to track down and apprehend Wu. The police chief, who was supposed to be on call, was at a reception in Busan and then a sauna as well. So he was just hanging out in a sauna. National Police Headquarters in Seoul did not receive any word about the shootings until around 1:40 a.m., though that could have been due to the phone line, phone operation being basically down. If you don't have anyone to operate the calls, I get it. Like, if you don't know how to operate a switchboard, you're not going to be able to. Finally, as the police closed in, we set off 2 grenades. He and 3 of the hostages he had taken were killed, although Saul survived. The sort of patriarch of the house survived. In response to the tragedy, the police chief who was supposed to be on call was suspended, and 4 police officers were arrested on charges of negligence of duty. Now, again, the sources that we have all say something different for the final head count. Some people say 60 died. Some people say 62. Some people say 57 and 30 wounded. There is not a particularly clear picture of the amount of casualties and survivors, or wounded. So again, we know he murdered in the upper 50s, but the exact number is still debated to this day. So that is the story. So Caitlin, why don't you give us some legal context or legal details?
So so most of the time when we hear of a shooting, especially nowadays, we start to think of how or why this could happen. Like, what was the impetus for this? Like, what typically this leads into a discussion on gun laws and whether they need to be strengthened or not strengthened. Or again, we kind of have to look at the history of South Korea a little bit more. And I'm going to go back to the war, the Korean War. So in the Korean War began in 1950 and it lasted until 1953. It is, I say ended, but technically it's still going. There's just a ceasefire agreement. As most people know, yeah, there's a ceasefire. So civilians at this time were allowed to have guns because of obviously the war. And they weren't collected after the war. A lot of people were in the military. They were fighting for the country. They were, you know, so they still had that stuff. Both Koreas were very devastated. They were just, there's casualty on all sides, including the UN team, just on all sides. There was a lot of destruction. So that also just means destructions of homes, farmland. A lot of, actually, up until like 1960s, there was a lot of rice paddies. Also, important buildings were gone. After the war, the economy of South Korea, it was struggling. It was struggling behind North Korea. Now we know that's not the case today, but back then it was. So it was, South Korea was less developed until the 1960s. And this was under South Korea's 3rd president. He was General Park Chung-hee. So if you ever heard of the first female president of Korea, it was her father. So Park Geun-hye is the daughter of Park Jung-hee. Now, I'm going to show you a picture of him. This is Park Jung-hee. So he took over via a coup in 1961 and began a protectionist economic policy and export-oriented. So he wanted a lot of Korean products be exported. But that also meant that foreign products were restricted. So imports on foreign products were restricted. So chaebols or conglomerates such as we know them today, Samsung, LG, Hyundai, they're all part of the we need to get our products into foreign markets kind of policy that he had. So this is known as the miracle on the Han River or Hangangi Gijo. During Park's time as president, there was continued gun violence. And this resulted in the confiscation of guns. And this was only guns owned by civilians. So this is when the law on guns were revised. Mm-hmm. Would also like to make a note that in 1972, Park declared martial law and punished those who were politically opposed to his policies and his leadership. So he became kind of made society, like tensions were high. So after he was assassinated in 1979, and after this is the president that we said he was the fifth president of the Republic of Korea. And this was Jeon Doo-hwan. And Jeon Doo-hwan, I have a picture of him too, Jeon Doo-hwan. So he's the one that Ubomgon was born under. So under Jeon, gun laws were strict, and even under Park, gun violence had started to decrease. And so ownership of guns is found in Korea on the Act on the Safety Management of Guns, Swords, Explosives. Swords. So it's such a long title. But okay, so now we're going to go to the law because I don't want to... Chapter 3 is possession and use of weapons, use of guns, swords, explosives, gas sprayers, electroshock weapons, and crossbows. This is a very
gas sprayers?
Yes, gas sprayers. Maybe like a... I know in Canada it's illegal to have a... What do you call it?
Peppers... Okay. No offense, that's ridiculous.
I know, we can't have that. You can have bear spray, but you can't have pepper spray.
You know what? Then I would carry bear spray everywhere.
Okay, so no one, it says here. So let's look. Article 10, prohibition of possession. So no one shall possess guns, swords, explosive gas sprays, electroshock weapons, or crossbows without permission, except for the following cases. So where it is permitted to perform duties. So, can we think about someone who would perform duties with firearms for a second? Who would those people be?
Oh, I wonder. Police,
right? And actually, you will see them with revolvers in Korea. They have revolvers.
And I'm trying to remember.
Where a manufacturer possesses guns, swords, explosives, manufactured by himself or herself. Manufacturers. Where a person who has manufactured explosives pursuant to the provision of Article 4 possesses explosive manufactured. So you can have, if you manufacture them. I think you have to be a manufacturer. There's also laws on if you are how to be a manufacturer and all that. Where a gun dealer possesses cartridge or blank cartridges for guns he or she sells.
It's not illegal to manufacture something if it's your job.
So where a renter possesses guns, so you can rent them, but I guess there's conditions on that too.
Oh yeah, for like shooting ranges. I guess
maybe
here.
Like a shooting range, yeah. Mm-hmm. Where a person who has obtained permission to export or import. So this could be for like Olympics, because they will have, sometimes the Olympics will have shooting, right? They do, yeah. They have shooting. Where a person who has obtained permission to use explosives.
Oh, from construction.
Yeah.
They blew up the mountain where Panggyo is now.
Where a person who has obtained permission to take over under Article 21 possesses relevant explosives. I'm not going to read Article 21. Where an employee of a person falling under any of the subparagraphs. So an employee maybe working in a gun dealer, a dealer, a manufacturer.
Mm-hmm. Or construction, etc.
And where a person prescribed by presidential decree. So no one shall manufacture, sell, or possess that anything that looks like a gun. No one shall manufacture, sell, or possess those prescribed by presidential decree as launchers that are likely to harm human life, human bodies, or property by discharging projectiles made of metallic or non-metallic materials.
Oof.
Okay. Remember, this is also the English version of the Grand Laws, so some of it may sound a little awkward. So also, you need to, so when you do try go and get a gun, you have to be 20. Okay. The law states that you must be 20. I will read that in a minute. You also have to, it says he or she shall submit documents prescribed by the ordinance of the Ministry of the Interior and Safety to a permitting agency by which mental illness, personality disorder of the applicant can be verified. So there is a mental check. So someone has to sign off on that. The commissioner of a city police agency having jurisdiction over his or her drives. Okay. These kind of grounds for disqualification, a person who is under. So they don't do, they do it the opposite language that we would do. You must be blah, blah, blah. It's okay. Disqualification. You're under 20. You cannot.
Okay. Okay. So instead of
saying,
well, you must be over 20.
You cannot be under 20.
Mm.
But this does not apply again when you're doing Olympics. So if you're doing Olympics and it gets approved by certain layers of government and the Olympic Committee, then they can have a target rifle. A mentally defective person,
oof,
a person addicted to narcotic drugs, marijuana, psychotropic substances, or alcohol, or a mentally ill person or a person with epilepsy who is prescribed by presidential decree. So they cannot have a gun.
Okay, I get, okay, one psychotropic drug.
Yeah.
Well, where are you getting
marijuana
that?
Marijuana is not.
Yeah, we know all of that is very illegal, but like,
is very
illegal. Yeah, Mary Jane has no last dance here.
Okay, a person for whom 5 years have not passed since the date of execution of the sentence was completed. Not execution, not death execution, just when they complete. So after. Person for whom 5 years have, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, the execution is, yeah, it's when their crime is deemed complete 5 years from there.
For whom 5 years have not passed since the date he or she was sentenced to a fine for violating this act. So if they've done anything with guns or explosives or anything like that or swords. A person for whom 5 years have not passed since the date a stay period ends. After being sentenced to a fine or a stay of execution, imprisonment with labor or heavier punishment for committing a specific violent crime, falling under, there's a whole bunch of different violent crimes. So
you can be sentenced to heavy labor these days. I did not know that.
Yeah.
In lieu of jail time, heavy labor. Okay. Construction work for you, 2 years.
So we're going to go on to Article 14-2, which is storage of guns. So this is a person who obtains permission to possess a gun shall keep the gun and cartridges or blank cartridges in a place designated by a permitting agency. This is usually a police station.
Hmm.
Usually civilians do have to keep their guns at the police stations. And they're all registered, so they know who it belongs to. Where a person permitted to possess a gun intends to use the gun for permitted use or where good cause exists, he or she shall file an application to lift the storage restriction. But you need to, I believe you need to tell them where you're going to store it.
Mm. Yeah, you can't just be like, okay, I bring guns home now.
Yeah. Yeah. So also like hunting and, you know. And then they also have to renew. So they renew the permission every 3 years. And you have to use it for specific purposes, obviously. Like,
yeah, but they have a reason hunting, in the license. Like yeah.
Hunting, but I don't. Most people just use rifles. Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to refer everybody, if you're in Canada, to Runkle of the Bailey. He will tell you what's legal and what's not. He is a lawyer in Canada. That is not legal advice, but he knows things.
He knows the stuff.
He knows the stuff. And boop, we're back. Okay. So those are the gun laws in Korea now. So you have to be. So. Too long, didn't read. The law states you must be 20 years old. You must present documents to verify mental health status. It must be stored. It must be in a case, cartridges or blanks separate from the gun stored. That's actually the same in Canada. And there you must. Usually they're located at a police station that you have to. And transporting is only for when going to the shooting range or hunting and it has to be unloaded. Again, ammo and gun separate, kept separate. So those are the laws. Before that wasn't the case. So yeah, so renewal is performed every 3 years. So Kim Yong-dae of the KNPA told Korea Exposé, all guns must be stored at the local police station and all permits require extensive background checks, including documents to prove legitimate reasons for gun ownership and physical and psychiatric assessments. So you must be in good. So how
you have to say why?
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. So how was Woo able to commit this tragedy? Well, first, he was a police officer. So possessing a gun at this time, even after the gun laws, these strict gun laws were introduced, he was a police officer. So it's a normal part of his job duties. Like we saw, if it's in your job duties, you can have it. Also, as said by Ashley, Woo grabbed a gun while the other police officers were in a meeting or doing whatever. And the others that were supposed to be at the desk were not there to notice or stop him. Where he began was a small village where many people didn't know him and didn't really know the exact temperament. Remember, before he was in Busan where he was hitting people, but this town, it wasn't actually specified whether he was the county that he was doing this. So I don't have an answer to this. But I do wonder if the police force, they have to submit their mental health records to obtain their service of firearm. I believe now they probably do.
But not in 1982.
But not, probably not in 1982.
Let's say pilots, right? So pilots went immediately from like, if they were over a certain rank, if they were lieutenant in the Air Force, they immediately went to the captain seat at Korean Air. Right. So I'm guessing it's kind of similar, right? You go to the army. Okay. You're getting hired as a police officer. There's not like, there's no transition retraining period. It's, oh, you achieved this. Okay. You're here now, you know?
Yeah.
So it would have been insulting to them to test or say, oh, do you have the skill to do this? They would have been like, oh, I was in the army or, oh, I was a lieutenant, you know? So
yeah.
Like, yeah.
So, or if maybe even other requirements for civilians have to be met before they even became an officer. So I'm pretty sure I said this before, but I find Korea to be a very safe place. I could take walks at night by myself in my area. Of course, I know crime occurs there, but
I mean, hello.
Hello. But I've always felt safe. As many might know, in the summer, there was actually an increase of violence with knives this summer. And this is anger, stress, and mental health. They seem to be the causes for this. I know that guns, knives, or any weapon, anything that you can use to become, can become a weapon, can inflict harm to others. But I think a focus on stress management and general mental health should help prevent situations like this and the recent knife attacks. As we know, mental health is not always discussed about in Korea. It's very still kind of hush-hush. It is getting better.
It's stigmatized.
It's very stigmatized and it is getting better. It's not to say that they don't have those doctors. They definitely do. It's just how many people actually go see them. And you've heard of self-unaliving from a lot of former K-pop stars and actresses and actors and stuff like that. And it's just terrible. Now,
and even, sorry to interrupt you. Even in when we were both teaching at the same place, it was, he has, like, for example, ADHD, something as simple as ADHD, which of course.
So also because we talked about the self-unaliving of Bumgun, I just also want to put some suicide hotlines at helplines. And if you have any, if you know someone suffering or if anyone is suffering, these are the following helplines that you can call. So Canada is 1-833-456-4566. In USA, they actually got rid of the 10-digit phone number, so now it's 988.
Oh.
And South Korea is 1-588-9191. So if you know someone struggling or if you are struggling, please let someone know and give them a call.
Is there an English line in Korea?
Another suicide prevention line is 1393 in Korea. And they do have counselors and there's Christline counts. There is, I do know especially that there is some international clinics inside hospitals and they usually have English counselors that you can go to. So there's ones like Ewha and all the big major, I know they're more expensive.
University hospitals.
Hospitals. they have, usually they'll have an international clinic. So if I know in Seoul, especially, and they are branching out into, well, Busan would have some, you know. So it, again, also you can use, I believe it's called Danuri, the translation.
Okay.
So if you need translation, I couldn't find an actual English or other languages, but please don't hesitate to contact those numbers if you or someone else is suffering.
If you need help, say something before something happens. Yeah. And if you notice behavior in someone else, encourage them to get help.
Okay. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Ashley, you want to say bye to everyone?
Thank you so much. If you have any suggestions, if you come across something that you think is particularly interesting, we would be more than happy to do a deep dive into that. Thank you for listening to the topic today. I hope it was interesting for you. And we'll see you next time. And we promise it won't be 6 months in between.
And also, if you have any case suggestions, you can email us at choreocrimepodcast@gmail.com. All right. Thank you so much. And we'll see you next time.